you. They had allowed two machine guns to pin them down while the three columns of Easy ran 200 yards across the field in a bayonet charge. They had reacted much too slowly when Winters fired on them from the road. They failed to put together an organized base of fire when the shooting started. Easy, by contrast, did almost everything right. Winters called this the highlight of all E Company actions for the entire war, even better than D-Day, because it demonstrated Easy's overall superiority in every phase of infantry tactics, patrol, defense, attack under a base of fire, withdrawal, and above all, superior marksmanship with rifles, machine gun, and mortar fire. More can be said. For example, the physical fitness of the Easy men was a sine qua non. They put out more energy than a heavyweight boxer in a 15-round title match. Way more. They put out more energy than a man would playing 60 minutes in three consecutive football games. Also notable was the company's communication system, with radio messages, runners, and hand signals being used effectively. The leapfrog advances and retreats put into play the training they had undergone at Tekoa and were carried out in textbook fashion. The evacuation of the wounded was likewise carried out with calm efficiency. The coordination with British artillery was outstanding. So was Winters. He made one right decision after another, sometimes instinctively, sometimes after careful deliberation. The best was his decision that to attack was his only option. He provided not only brains, but personal leadership. "Follow me," was his code. He personally killed more Germans and took more risks than anyone else. But good as Easy Company of the 506th was, and there was no better light infantry company in the army, there was nothing it could do about that terror of the battlefield, modern artillery. Easy had to cross the dike to get home. It could not stay in the open field and get pounded. But in crossing the dike, the company exposed itself to zeroed-in German artillery. A few minutes of total terror, and the company had taken more casualties than it had in its encounter with German riflemen by the hundreds earlier in the day. "Artillery is a terrible thing," Webster said. "God, I hate it." The Public Relations Office of the 101st Airborne Division gave the action extensive publicity in typical wartime jargon. "Winter's order had to be and was for a bayonet attack. As a result of that brave order, two companies of SS were heavily battered and forced to withdraw without getting an opportunity to start their attack, which was scheduled to start at almost that very instant." Insofar as the German 363rd Volksgrenadier Division launched a major attack at Ophüsden at dawn that day against the left flank of the 506th, the small action at the dike may have been crucial. Had the German SS companies proceeded unmolested south of the dike, they would have hit regimental HQ at exactly the moment Colonel Sink had to concentrate his attention on Ophüsden. Sink was appreciative. He issued a general order citing 1st Platoon of Easy for gallantry in action. After describing the bayonet charge, he wrote, "By this daring act and skillful maneuver against a numerically superior force, the platoon inflicted heavy casualties on the enemy and turned back the enemy's attempt to attack Battalion HQ from the rear." A couple of days after the bayonet attack, Colonel Sink paid Winters a visit. "Do you think you could handle the battalion?" he asked, indicating that he was considering making Winters the XO of 2nd Battalion. Major Oliver Horton had been killed in the Battle of Ophüsden on October 5th. Winters, 26 and a half years old, a captain and company commander for only 3 months, gulped and replied, "Yes, sir. I know I can handle our battalion in the field. Combat doesn't worry me. It's the administration. I've never had administration." "Don't worry," Sink assured him. "I'll take care of that part." On October 9th, he made Winters the XO of 2nd Battalion. Winters' replacement as Easy Company commander failed to measure up. He came in from another battalion. Private Ralph Stafford was scathing in his description. "He really screwed up. He not only didn't know what to do, he didn't care to learn. He stayed in bed, made no inspections, and sent for more plums. He was shortly relieved. Other replacement officers had also failed. Christensen said of one, "Indecision was his middle name. In combat, his mind became completely disoriented, and he froze. We, the NCOs of the platoon, took over and got the job done, and never did he complain, for he realized his inability to command under pressure." Webster wrote about a platoon leader in the Nunen fight. "I never saw him in the fracas. He never came to the front. He failed to live up to his responsibilities. The old men in the platoon never forgave him. For an enlisted man to fail in a grave situation was bad, but for an officer who was supposed to lead his men, it was inexcusable." Malarkey related that in that fight, Guarnieri was giving hell to some officer who had his head buried in the sand, telling him he was supposed to be leading the platoon. The same officer was later seen at an aid station, shot through the hand, suspected of being self-inflicted. A combination of new officers and men who had not been trained up to the standard of the original Kurhi group, the rigors of constant pounding by artillery, and the danger of night patrols was taking a toll on Easy. The conditions exacerbated the situation. Paul Fussell has described the two stages of rationalization a combat soldier goes through. "It can't happen to me." Then, "It can happen to me unless I'm more careful." Followed by a stage of accurate perception. "It is going to happen to me, and only my not being there, on the front lines, is going to prevent it." Some men never get to the perception. For others, it comes almost at once. When it does come to a member of a rifle company in the front line, it is almost impossible to make him stay there and do his duty. His motivation has to be internal. Comradeship is by far the strongest motivator. Not wanting to let his buddies down in the positive sense, not wanting to appear a coward in front of the men he loves and respects above all others in the negative sense. Discipline won't do it, because discipline relies on punishment, and there is no punishment the Army can inflict on a frontline soldier worse than putting him on the front line. Except certain death. The Wehrmacht in Normandy, for example, had German sergeants standing behind foreign conscripts. A Pole in the Wehrmacht at Omaha Beach managed to be taken prisoner. At his interrogation, he was asked how the frontline troops stood up to the air and naval pounding. "Your bombs were very persuasive," he replied, "but the sergeant behind me with a pistol in his hand was more so." But the American Army didn't do things that way. One reason for this is what Glenn Gray calls the tyranny of the present in a foxhole. The past, and more important, the future, do not exist. He explains that there is more time for thinking and more loneliness in foxholes at the front than in secure homes, and time is measured in other ways than by clocks and calendars. To the soldier under fire who has reached his limit, even the most horrible army jail looks appealing. What matters is living through the next minute. Gray speculates that this is why soldiers will go on such extraordinary lengths to get souvenirs. At Braecourt Manor, Malarkey ran out into a field being raked by machine gun fire to get what he thought was a Luger from a dead German. In Holland on October 5th, as Webster was limping back to the rear in an open field under fire from a German 88, he spotted a German camouflage poncho, an ideal souvenir. He stopped to scoop it up. Gray explains the phenomenon. Primarily, souvenirs appeared to give the soldier some assurance of his future beyond the destructive environment of the present. They represented a promise that he might survive. It is almost impossible to think of anything but survival in a life-threatening situation, which accounts for the opposite phenomenon to souvenir grabbing. The soldier's casual attitude toward his own possessions, his indifferent attitude toward money. In campaigns of extreme hazard, Gray writes, soldiers learn more often than civilians ever do that everything external is replaceable, while life is not. What is not replaceable is the esteem of comrades. But to the replacement soldier just arrived, there is no comradeship, so there is nothing to hold him to his post. Gray tells the story of a deserter he found in a woods in France in November 1944. The lad was from the Pennsylvania mountains. He was accustomed to camping out. He had been there a couple weeks and intended to stay until the war ended. "All the men I knew and trained with have been killed or transferred," the deserter explained. "I'm lonely. The shells seem to come closer all the time, and I can't stand them." He begged Gray to leave him. Gray refused, said he would have to turn him in, but promised he would not be punished. The soldier said he knew that. He bitterly predicted they would simply put him back into the line again, which was exactly what happened when Gray brought him in. At the front, not only spit-and-polish discipline breaks down, orders can be ignored, as supervision is not exact where danger of death is present. Old soldiers have learned by bitter experience to be independent and to make their own decisions. Webster wrote his parents shortly after he was wounded, "Once our lieutenant told my squad leader to take his 8 men and knock out some anti-aircraft guns that were firing on a flight of gliders. 9 men with rifles fighting dual-purpose 88s and 40 millimeters. The sergeant said, yes, censored. By using his own judgment, he saved our lives in a situation where a new man would have rushed in blindly. This same lieutenant later ordered 2 scouts into a German position, but they, knowing better, got censored. Veterans tried to help replacements, but they also took care not to learn their names, as they expected them to be gone shortly. It was not that the old hands had no sympathy for the recruits. "Our new members," Webster wrote his parents, "representatives of the 18-year-old draft, were so young and enthusiastic-looking, it seemed a crime to send them into battle. We paratroopers get the best men in the army, but it's a hell of a fate for somebody who's never been away from home or high school to come here." No man in Easy had been in combat before June 6, 1944. But by October, all the men who took off from England on the evening of June 5th, who were still alive in Holland, had been through 2 combat jumps and 2 campaigns. Many of them had been wounded. Some of the wounded had gone AWOL from the hospital to go to Holland. This was not because they had a love of combat, but because they knew if they did not go to war with Easy, they would be sent to war with strangers, as the only way out of combat for a rifleman in ETO was death or wound serious enough to cost a limb. If they had to fight, they were determined it would be with their comrades. Replacements could seldom reach this level of identification. Further, as the Army was speeding up the training process to provide men for the battle, the replacements were not of the quality of the original Currahee men. At Fechel, Webster saw a replacement named Max moaning and clutching his right hand. "Help me, help me, somebody help me." "What's wrong? Shot anywhere else?" "No, no, it hurts." "Why don't you get up and run?" He didn't feel like it. He was in shock so bad he just wanted to lie there and moan. It's a funny thing about shock. Some boys can have their foot blown off and come limping back to the aid station under their own power, while others, like Max, freeze up at the sight of blood and refuse to help themselves. They say that shock is largely physical, but it seems to me that one's mental attitude has a lot to do with it. Max wasn't aggressive, he wasn't hard, he wasn't well-trained. That officers and men broke under the constant strain, tension, and vulnerability is not remarkable. What is remarkable is that so many did not break. With Winter's replacement gone, First Lieutenant Fred Moose Heiliger took over the company. Heiliger was an OCS graduate who had led the HQ Company Mortar Platoon in Normandy, where he was promoted to First Lieutenant, and Holland. He had been in E Company back in the States. From the first, Winters liked him immensely. Heiliger was a good CO. He visited the outposts at night. He went on patrols himself. He saw to the men as best could be done. Like the men in the foxholes, he never relaxed. The tension was always there. His company was spread much too thin to prevent German patrols from penetrating the line, and the dangerous possibility of another breakthrough of the size of that of October 5th was in his mind constantly. He bore up under the responsibility well, took the strain, did his duty. The British are masters of intrigue, according to Corporal Walter Gordon. I wouldn't necessarily want them on my flank for an assault on some target, but I sure would like to have them plan it, because they are very good at planning. He was referring to the rescue, which took place at midnight, October 22nd to 23rd. A week earlier, Colonel O. Dobie, nicknamed the Mad Colonel of Arnhem, of the British 1st Airborne Division, who had escaped from a German hospital after being made prisoner, had swum across the Rhine and contacted Colonel Sink. Dobie said there were 125 British troops, some 10 Dutch resistance fighters who were being sought by the Germans, and 5 American pilots hiding out with the Dutch underground on the north side of the Lower Rhine. He wanted to get them back, and he needed help. Sink agreed to cooperate. As the crossing point was across from Easy's position, Sink volunteered Heiliger to lead the rescue patrol. Or, as Gordon put it, "We would furnish the personnel, the British would furnish the idea, and, I suppose, the band-aids." A fair swap by British standards. Dobie was in contact with the Dutch underground on the far side by telephone. For some reason, the Germans had never cut those lines. He designated the night of October 22nd, 23rd for the operation. The American 81st AAAT Battalion would fire tracers over the river with their Bofors guns to mark the spot where the Dutch would bring the men waiting to be rescued. To allay German suspicion, for several nights before the operation, the 81st fired tracers at midnight. On the appointed night, Heiliger, Lieutenants Welsh and Edward Shames, and 17 men selected by Heiliger, followed engineer tape from the dike down to the river, where British canvas collapsible boats had been hidden the previous evening. It was, as usual, a murky night, with a drizzle adding to the obscurity. The shivering men edged the boats into the river. At midnight, the Bofors fired the tracers straight north. The Dutch underground blinked the V for victory signal with red flashlights from the north bank. Easy began paddling as silently as possible across the river. The men crossed with pounding hearts, but without incident. They leaped out of the boats and moved forward. Gordon had the machine gun on the left flank. He set it up and prepared to defend against attack. Corporal Francis Mellett had the machine gun on the right flank. Private Stafford was at the point for the column seeking contact with the Dutch underground, Heiliger immediately behind him. Stafford moved forward stealthily. There was no firing, no illumination. This was enemy territory completely unfamiliar to the Americans, and it was pitch black. "The absolute quiet was almost petrifying to me," Stafford remembered. Stafford took another cautious step. A large bird flew up not more than a foot away from his face. "I am positive my heart stopped beating," Stafford recalled. "I flipped off the safety on my M1 and was about to fire when Lieutenant Heiliger calmly said, 'Easy.'" They continued on and shortly met the British troops. The first one Stafford saw hugged me and gave me his red beret, which I still have. A British brigadier stepped forward and shook Heiliger's hand, saying he was the finest-looking American officer he had ever seen. Heiliger motioned for the British to move in column to the boats, urging them to keep silent, but they just could not. Private Lester Hashey recalled one saying, "I never thought I'd be so glad to see a bloody Yank." Lieutenant Welsh, who was in charge down at the boats, grew exasperated with the Brits, who kept calling out, "God bless you, Yank," and told them they would all get killed if they didn't shut up. The British got into the boats. Heiliger pulled his men back in leapfrog fashion. Soon everyone was ready to shove off. Gordon was the last one back and in the trailing boat crossing the river. There was a certain amount of excitement and urgency, he said. And he was certain the Germans would sink them all any moment. But they were never spotted. By 01:30, the entire party were safely on the south bank and crossing no man's land on the way to the American front line behind the dike. The next day, Colonel Sink issued a citation for gallantry in action. He declared that the courage and calmness shown by the covering force was a major factor in this successful execution. So well organized and executed was this undertaking that the enemy never knew an evacuation had taken place. All members of this covering force are commended for their aggression, spirit, prompt obedience of orders, and devotion to duty. Their names appear below. Gordon's name is there. When I suggested that he must be proud to have volunteered for and carried out so well such a hazardous operation, he said the only reason he went along was that Heiliger had selected him. It was not a volunteer operation. I'm not saying I wouldn't have volunteered. I'm just saying I didn't volunteer. On October 28th, the 101st Division's area of responsibility was enlarged. The 506th shifted to the east on the riverbank, just opposite Arnhem. Easy was in the line in the vicinity of the village of Driel, which put the company in the easternmost tip of the Allied advance toward Germany. It was replacing a British unit. As the company moved into its new position, Sergeant Lipton and Battalion XO Winters talked with the British commander. He said they could see Germans moving around and digging in along the railroad track to the east. Easy was still on the right flank of the 506th at Driel. That put it at the point where the line bent at an acute angle, meaning one platoon faced north, another east, with the third in reserve. "Well, when you see them, why don't you fire on them?" Winters asked. "Because when we fire on them, they just fire back." Winters and Lipton looked at each other in disbelief. Easy always tried to keep the German heads down and on the defensive whenever it occupied the front line. It did so at Driel and kept up active patrolling. The artillery continued to pound away. The Germans still had the advantage of holding the high ground north of the river, so movement by day was impossible. The platoons in the front line lived in foxholes. The rain was all but constant. No one ever got really dry. No shaves, no showers, no relaxation, a miserable existence. To the rear, at the CPs and further back, conditions improved somewhat. Artillery was a problem, of course, but there was hot food and other compensations. The men listened to Arnim Annie, a German propagandist broadcaster, over the radio. Between American songs, she invited them to cross the river, surrender, and live in comfort until the war was over. The supply people were able to bring copies of Yank and Stars and Stripes to the men. The 101st's daily news sheet, the Kangaroo Chronicle, resumed publishing. The Germans dropped leaflets, "Why Fight for the Jews?" The 506th POW interrogation team broadcast over a loudspeaker surrender invitations to the Germans. The only effect of the propaganda, by both sides, was to bring a good laugh. Winters was bored. Being XO was a letdown, a tremendous letdown. The most fun I had in the Army, the most satisfying thing I did, was company commander. Being a junior officer was a tough job, taking it from both sides, from the men and from Captain Sobel. But as a company commander, I was running my own little show. I was out front, making a lot of personal decisions on the spot that were important to the welfare of my company, getting a job done. But as Battalion XO, I was an administrator, not making any command decisions or such, just recommendations to the battalion commander, to the battalion S2. I suggested that some people would feel a sense of relief at the change. "I didn't," Winters replied. First Lieutenant Harry Welsh's 2nd Platoon had the sector of the line facing east. His CP was in a barn some 50 meters west of the railroad tracks, where the Germans had their outposts. His platoon strength was down to 24 men. Even if he kept half of them on alert, that meant 12 men to cover a front of 1,500 meters. With a more than 200-meter gap between outposts, it was relatively easy for German patrols to penetrate the line after dark. They did so regularly, not with the purpose of mounting an attack. Like the Allies, they had accepted the static situation, and their lines were thinly held too, but to make certain the Americans were not building up. After his experiences on October 5th, Winters was worried about the porous situation at the front. When he heard a member of the rescue mission of October 22nd, 23rd describe the penetration of German lines without being spotted as fantastic, he snorted, "The Germans did the same thing to us. They got two companies across, and we never fired a shot at them until they got up on the dike. So what's the big deal?" Winters was also frustrated in his new job. He craved action and fretted over the German penetrations. On the afternoon of October 31st, he called Heiliger on the telephone to suggest that that night the two of them make their own inspection of the outposts. Heiliger agreed. At 2100 hours that evening, Winters arrived at Easy's CP. Heiliger telephoned Welsh to let him know that he and Winters were on their way out to see him. As Moose and I proceeded down the path leading to Welsh's CP, Winters related, we were walking shoulder to shoulder as the path was only about 6 feet wide, slightly raised. There was a drop of about 3 feet into a drainage ditch on each side. Out of the darkness came an order, "Halt!" Heiliger was a calm, easygoing man, a CO who did not get excited unnecessarily. So when Winters felt him take an extra hard breath, he tensed. Winters figured Heiliger had forgotten the password. Heiliger started to say "Moose," but before he got the words half out, blam, 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 an M1 spat 3 bullets out from a distance of 10 yards. Heiliger dropped to the road with a moan. Winters dived into the ditch on the left side of the road. He feared they had run into a German patrol because the M1 fire had been so rapid it could have been a German machine pistol. Then he heard footsteps running away. Winters crawled back onto the path, grabbed Heiliger, and pulled him to the side. He had been hit in the right shoulder, a fairly clean wound, and in the left leg, a bad one. His calf looked like it had been blown away. Winters set to bandaging the leg. A few minutes later, Winters heard footsteps running his way. As he moved to grab his rifle, he heard Welsh calling in a low voice, "Moose? Dick?" Welsh and two of his men helped bandage Heiliger. They gave him morphine shots and carried him back to the battalion CP. By then he had lost so much blood and had had so many shots of morphine, he had a wax-like pallor that made Winters doubt he was going to make it. He made it. Within a week he was back in a hospital in England. While there, he was promoted to captain and given the British Military Cross for the rescue patrol. But for Heiliger, the war was over. The soldier who shot Heiliger had been tense, frightened, unsure of himself. The incident broke him up. He was a veteran, not a recruit. Winters decided not to punish him. Soon thereafter, he was eased out of the company. On November 7th, Heiliger wrote Winters from his hospital bed, "Dear Dick, here I am, laying flat on my back, taking it easy. I want to thank you for taking care of me that night I got hit. It sure is a stupid way to get knocked off. I arrived here naked as a jaybird, didn't have a thing. I know you have my wings and pistol, but I am sweating out the clothes in my bedroll and the rolls of film in my musette bag. Jesus, Dick, they put casts right over my wounds, and it smells as if a cat shit in my bed. I can't get away from that stink. Well, this is short, but my right arm is very weak. Remember me to all." Heiliger's replacement as CO of Easy was First Lieutenant Norman S. Dyke, Jr. He came over from Division HQ, tall, slim, good-looking. He was well-educated and talked in a military tone of voice. He made a good impression. Being XO put Winters into daily contact with Nixon, by now Battalion S3. They hardly could have been more different. Winters grew up in a middle-class home. Nixon's father was fabulously wealthy. Winters had not gotten out of Pennsylvania in his teenage years. Nixon had lived in various parts of Europe. Winters was a graduate of a small college. Nixon came from Yale. Winters never drank. Nixon was an alcoholic. But they were the closest of friends because what they had in common was a dedication to the job at hand, and a remarkable ability to do that job. Every member of Easy interviewed for this book said Winters was the best combat commander he ever saw, while Nixon was the most brilliant staff officer he knew in the war. Nixon was a hard man to get out of the sack in the morning, according to Winters. One day in November, Winters wanted to get an early start. Nixon, as usual, could not be talked into getting up. Winters went to his bed, grabbed his feet while he was still in his sleeping bag, and threw them over his shoulder. "Are you going to get up? Go away. Leave me alone." Winters noticed that the water pitcher was half full. Still holding Nixon's feet on his shoulder, he grabbed the pitcher and started pouring the contents on Nixon's face. Nixon opened his eyes. He was horrified. "No, no," he begged. Too late. The contents were on their way. Only then did Winters realize that Nixon had not gone outside to piss away the liquor he had drunk, but used the water pitcher instead. Nixon yelled and swore and then started laughing. The two officers decided to go to Nijmegen to investigate the rumor that hot showers were available for officers there. The campaign dragged on. Increasing cold added to the misery of the daily rains. Finally, in late November, Canadian units began to replace the 101st. Easy's turn came on the night of November 24th, 25th, when it pulled out of the line. In the morning, the men boarded trucks for the trip back to France for rest, refitting, receiving replacements, and a shower, which the enlisted men had not had in 69 days. Easy had jumped on September 17th with 154 officers and men. It came out of Holland with 98 officers and men. Lieutenants Brewer, Compton, Heiliger, and Charles Hudson had been wounded, along with 45 enlisted men. The Easy men killed in action were William Dukeman, Jr., James Campbell, Vernon Menza, William Miller, James Miller, Robert Van Klinken. The company had taken 65 casualties in Normandy, so its total at the end of November was 120. Some of these men had been wounded in both campaigns, of whom not one was a prisoner of war. As the trucks rolled back down Hell's Highway, the Dutch lined the roads to cheer their liberators. "September 17th," they shouted as the convoy moved through Nijmegen, Uden, Fechel, Eindhoven. The men of Easy did not feel like conquering heroes. Sergeant Lipton summed it up. "Arnhem Annie said over the radio, 'You can listen to our music, but you can't walk in our streets.' She was right. We didn't get into Arnhem." Chapter 10. Resting, Recovering, and Refitting. Moulmein-en-Laguin, November 26th through December 18th, 1944. At 0400 November 26th, Easy arrived at Camp Moulmein, outside the village of Moulmein-en-Laguin. Nearby was the village of Moulmein-le-Petit, some 30 kilometers from the cathedral town and Champagne center of Reims. Moulmein had been a garrison town for at least 1,998 years. Julius Caesar and his Roman legions had used it as a campground in 54 BC. The French army had had barracks there for hundreds of years and still does in the 1990s. Located on the plain between the Marne River to the south and the Aisne River to the north, on the traditional invasion route toward Paris, or toward the Rhine, depending on who was on the offensive, Moulmein was in an area that had witnessed many battles through the centuries. Most recently, the area had been torn up between 1914 and 1918. The artillery craters and trenches from the last World War were everywhere. American doughboys had fought in the vicinity in 1918 at Chateau Thierry and Belleau Wood. The transition from front line to garrison duty was quick. The first day in camp featured a hot shower and a chance to launder clothes. The second day, the company had a marching drill. The next day, there was a regular retreat formation with cannon firing and inspection. On November 30th, the mail caught up with the men, boosting morale 100%. One might have thought that after more than 2 months on the front line, the paratroopers would have wanted to sleep for a week. But after one or two experiences of that miracle that is a soldier's night's sleep, The boys needed a physical outlet for their energy and some nonsensical way to release the built-up tension. On December 1st, everyone got a pass to Reims. So did the men of the 82nd Airborne, camped nearby. The mix was volatile. Although Reims was crawling with MPs, because it was Eisenhower's HQ, there was plenty to drink, and thus plenty of drunks and plenty of men who wanted to fight. "What's that eagle screaming for?" an 82nd man would ask his buddies when they encountered someone wearing the Screaming Eagle shoulder patch. "Help, help, help," was the reply, and a fistfight would start. On December 4th, all passes to Reims were canceled because, as one trooper put it, the boys won't behave in town. Division tried to work off some of the excess energy by ordering five-mile marches, parades, and lots of calisthenics. It also organized games of baseball, basketball, and football. It borrowed football equipment from the Air Force, flown in from England. Tryouts were held for a Christmas Day Champagne Bowl game between the 506th and the 502nd. Those who made the team practiced for 3 hours and more a day. For other entertainment, Division set up 3 movie theaters and opened a Red Cross club. The chow was superb. Several days after arrival at Mourmelon, the men got paid in the mess hall at the conclusion of dinner. Sergeant Malarkey drew his pay and had started out the door when he noticed a crap game in progress. A hot shooter had piled up a big bankroll. Malarkey thought he could not possibly continue to throw passes, so he started fading the shooter. In a few minutes, he had blown 3 months' pay. He left the mess hall thinking how dumb he was, not to have gambled, but to have lost everything without once shooting the dice himself. Back in barracks, he ran into Skip Muck. There was a dice game going on. Malarkey asked Muck if he intended to get in it. "No," Muck replied. He was tired of being broke all the time. Besides, he only had $60 left after paying off his previous gambling debts. Malarkey thereupon talked him into a $60 loan and got into the game. In 15 minutes, he had built himself a bankroll of French francs, British pounds, U.S. dollars, Belgian francs, and Dutch guilders. The arguments about the exchange rate around those crap games were intense. Somehow, these guys, most of whom had hated and mostly flunked math in high school, figured it out. Malarkey took his money over to the NCO club and got into a game with some 20 players. He threw $60 of U.S. money into the game, the amount he had borrowed from Muck. He won. He let it ride and won again, and again, and again. On the last throw, he had $3,000 riding. He won. He was afraid to leave the game with more than $6,000, which was damn near the whole company payroll. He put the large francs in his pocket and stayed in the game until he had lost all the American, British, Dutch and Belgian money. Returning to the barracks, he gave Muck the $60 plus a $500 tip. He still had $3,600. The men were put to work improving the barracks. The most recent occupants had been 2 divisions of German infantry plus several squadrons of light cavalry. German orders of the day, propaganda posters and the like, were on the walls. They came down. The leavings of the horses were cleaned up. Bunks were repaired. Latrines and roads improved. And through it all, like a bright thread, the 506th scrapbook Currahee declared, ran the anticipation of the Paris passes. Morning, noon, and night, anywhere you happened to be, you could hear it being discussed. Division policy was that the men would go into Paris by companies one at a time. The ones who made it came back with tales that topped those their fathers told after visiting Paris in 1918-1919. The ones who were waiting discussed endlessly what they were going to do when they got to the city. Some individuals got passes. In a couple of cases, they were wasted. Dick Winters got a pass. He went to Paris, got on the metro, rode to the end of the line, and discovered that he had taken the last run of the day. Darkness had fallen, the city was blacked out. He walked back to his hotel, got in well after midnight, and the next day returned by train to Mourmelon. That was my big night in Paris. Private Bradford Freeman from Lowndes County, Mississippi, got a pass to Paris. 46 years later, he recalled of his one day in the City of Lights. I didn't care for what I saw, so I went back to camp. There appeared to be no hurry about getting to Paris, as the general impression was that the paratroopers were going to stay in camp until the good campaigning weather returned in the spring. At that time, they expected to jump into Germany, on the far side of the Rhine. The impression was reinforced when General Taylor flew back to the States to participate in conferences regarding proposed changes in organization and equipment of the American Airborne Divisions. It became a certainty on December 10th, when Taylor's deputy, Brigadier General Gerald Higgins, flew to England with 5 senior officers from the 101st to give a series of lectures on Market Garden. Command passed to Brigadier General Anthony McAuliffe, the division's artillery commander. Veterans were returning from hospital. New recruits coming in. Buck Compton rejoined the company, recovered from his wound in Holland. Lieutenant Jack Foley, who had hooked up as a replacement during the last week in Holland, became assistant platoon leader of 2nd Platoon under Lieutenant Compton. The men, Foley remembered, were a mixture of seasoned combat veterans, some with just Holland under their belts, and of course, green replacements. The replacements, 18 and 19-year-olds fresh from the States, were wide-eyed. Although the veterans were only a year or two older, they looked terrifying to the recruits. They were supposed to have handed in their live ammunition when they left Holland, but almost none had done so. They walked around Camp Mourmelon with hand grenades hanging off their belts, clips of ammunition on their harness, wearing their knives and unauthorized sidearms. To the recruits, they looked like a bunch of killers from the French Foreign Legion. To the veterans, the recruits looked tender. Company Commander Lieutenant Dyke, Welsh, Shames, Foley, Compton, and other officers worked at blending the recruits into the outfit to bring them up to Easy's standard of teamwork and individual skills. But it was difficult, as the veterans could not take field maneuvers seriously. By the end of the second week in December, the company was back to about 65% of its strength in enlisted men. Officer strength was at 112.5%, with Dyke in command, Welsh serving as XO, and 2 lieutenants per platoon plus a spare. Put another way, the airborne commanders expected that casualties in the next action would be highest among the junior officer ranks. Welsh was by now the oldest serving officer in the company, and he had not been at Tekoa. Only Welsh and Compton had been in Normandy with Easy. Welsh, Compton, Dyke, Shames, and Foley had spent some time in Holland. It was the NCOs who were providing continuity and holding the company together. Among the NCOs who had started out at Tekoa as privates were Lipton, Talbert, Martin, Lutz, Perconte, Muck, Christensen, Randleman, Rader, Gordon, Toya, Guarnieri, Carson, Boyle, Guth, Taylor, Malarkey, and others. That so many of its Tekoa officers were on the 506th Regimental or 2nd Battalion staff helped Easy to maintain coherence. They included Major Hester and Captain Matheson, S3 and S4 on regimental staff, and Captains Winters and Nixon, XO and S2, on battalion staff. Overall, however, after one half year of combat, Easy had new officers and new privates. But its heart, the NCO Corps, was still made up of Tekoa men who had followed Captain Sobel up and down Currahee in those hot August days of 1942. Many of the men they had run up Currahee with were in hospital in England. Some of them would never run again. Others, with flesh wounds, were on the way to recovery. In the American 110th General Hospital outside Oxford, 3 members of 1st Platoon Easy Company were in the same ward. Webster, Liebgott, and Corporal Thomas McCreary had all been wounded on October 5th. Webster in the leg, Liebgott in the elbow, McCreary in the neck. Webster was practicing his writing. In his diary, he described his buddies. 120-pound Liebgott, ex-San Francisco cabbie, was the skinniest and, at non-financial moments, one of the funniest men in E Company. He had the added distinction of being one of the few Jews in the paratroops. In addition, both he and McCreary, ancient men of 30, were the company elders. McCreary was a light-hearted, good-natured little guy who, to hear him tell it, had been raised on a beer bottle and educated in the Motor Inn, Pittsburgh. According to Webster, the gayest spot in the 110th was the amputation ward, where most of the lads, knowing that the war was over for them, laughed and joked and talked about home. Webster was right to say most rather than all, as some of those with million-dollar wounds wouldn't have given a nickel for them. Leo Boyle, in another ward of the 110th, wrote Winters, "Dear Sir, now that I've got this far, damned if I know what to write. After two experiences, I can say it isn't all the shock of the wound that one carries away with him. It's the knowledge that you're out of the picture, fighting, for some time to come. In this, my case, a long time. I don't expect to be on my feet before Christmas. I do expect to be as good as new someday. There is no bone damage, just muscle and tissue damage, and a large area hard to graft. And, sir, I hope you take care of yourself. Better care than I've seen you exercise. For the reason, there are too few like you, and certainly none to replace you." He added that Webster, Liebgott, Leo Matz, Paul Rogers, George Lutz, and Bill Guarnieri, all also residents for varying periods of time of the 110th, had been in to see him. 44 years later, Boyle wrote, "I never became fully resigned to the separation from the life as a trooper, separated from my buddies, and never jumping again. I was hooked, or addicted to the life. I felt cheated and was often mean and surly about it during my year-long recuperation in the hospitals." Liebgott requested and got a discharge and a return to duty. So did McCreary, Guarnieri, and others. As noted, this was not because they craved combat, but because they knew they were going to have to fight with somebody and wanted it to be with Easy Company. "If I had my choice," Webster wrote his parents, "I'd never fight again. Having no choice, I'll go back to E Company and prepare for another jump. If I die, I hope it'll be fast." In another letter he wrote, "The realization that there is no escape, that we shall jump on Germany, then ride transports straight to the Pacific for the battle in China, does not leave much room for optimism. Like the infantry, our only way out is to be wounded and evacuated." Webster went to a rehabilitation ward, then toward the end of December to the 12th Replacement Depot in Tidworth, England. This repo depot, like its mate the 10th, was notorious throughout ETO for the sadism of its commander, its inefficiency, chicken-shit ways, filth, bad food, and general conditions that were not much of a step up from an army prison. Evidently, the army wanted to make it so bad that veterans recovered from their wounds, or partly recovered, or at least able to walk without support, would regard getting back to the front lines as an improvement. Jim Alley, wounded in Holland, recovered in hospital in England, went AWOL from the 12th Replacement Depot, and hitched a ride to Le Havre, then on to Mourmelon, where he arrived on December 15th. Guarnieri and others did the same. Webster did not. He had long ago made it a rule of his army life never to do anything voluntarily. He was an intellectual, as much an observer and chronicler of the phenomenon of soldiering as a practitioner. He was almost the only original Tocoa man who never became an NCO. Various officers wanted to make him a squad leader, but he refused. He was there to do his duty, and he did it. He never let a buddy down in combat, in France, Holland, or Germany. But he never volunteered for anything, and he spurned promotion. Excitement ran high in Mourmelon. Now that Easy was in a more or less permanent camp, the men could expect more mail and could hope that Christmas packages would catch up with them. There was the company furlough to Paris to anticipate. With a lot of luck, Easy might be in Paris for New Year's Eve. And there was the champagne bowl coming on Christmas Day, with a turkey dinner to follow. Betting was already heavy on the football game. The practice sessions were getting longer and tougher. The future after Christmas looked pretty good from the perspective of a rifle company in the middle of the greatest war ever fought. There would be no fighting for easy until at least mid-March. Then would come the jump into Germany. And after that, the move to the Pacific for fighting in China or a jump into Japan. But all that was a long way off. Easy got ready to enjoy Christmas. The sergeants had their own barracks at Mourmelon. On the night of December 16th, Martin, Guarnieri, and some others got hold of a case of champagne and brought it back to the sergeant's barracks. They were unaccustomed to the bubbly wine. Martin popped a few corks. The other sergeants held out their canteen cups. He filled them to the brim. "Well, hell, Johnny," Christensen said. "That's nothing but soda pop, for Christ's sake." They drank some of the world's finest champagne, as if it were soda pop, with inevitable results. A fight broke out, and I have to say I was in it, Martin admitted. And we tore every one of those bunks down, and nails sticking out. I ran nails into my foot. Hell, it was just a battle in there. First Sergeant Carwood Lipton came into the barracks, took one look, and started shouting, "You guys are supposed to be leaders! A bunch of sergeants doing all this crap!" He made them clean up the mess before allowing them to sleep it off. That same night, Winters and Nixon were the only two battalion staff officers at HQ. The others had taken off for Paris. Private Joe Lesniewski went to the movies at one of the Mourmelon theaters. He saw a film featuring Marlene Dietrich. Gordon Carson went to bed early to be ready for football practice in the morning. Winters and Nixon got word by radio that all passes were canceled. At the theater, the lights went on and an officer strode onto the stage to announce a German breakthrough in the Ardennes. In the barracks, Carson, Gordon, and others were awakened by the charge of quarters, who turned on the lights and reported the breakthrough. "Shut up," men called back at him. "Get the hell out of here. That was Eighth Corps' problem, First Army's problem." They went back to sleep. But in the morning, when the company fell in after reveille, Lieutenant Dyke told them, "After chow, just stand fast." He was not taking them out on a training exercise, as was customary. "Just stand by," were the orders. Dyke told them to kill the time by cleaning the barracks. Evidently, what was going on up in the Ardennes was going to be of concern to the 82nd and 101st Airborne after all. Hitler launched his last offensive on December 16th in the Ardennes, on a scale much greater than his 1940 offensive in the same place against the French army. He achieved complete surprise. American intelligence in the Ardennes estimated the German forces facing the 8th Corps at 4 divisions. In fact, by December 15th, the Wehrmacht had 25 divisions in the Eifel, across from the Ardennes. The Germans managed to achieve surprise on a scale comparable with Barbarossa in June 1941, or Pearl Harbor. The surprise was achieved, like most surprises in war, because the offensive made no sense. For Hitler to use up his armor in an offensive that had no genuine strategic aim, and one that he could not sustain unless his tankers were lucky enough to capture major American fuel dumps intact, was foolish. The surprise was achieved, like most surprises in war, because the defenders were guilty of gross overconfidence. Even after the failure of Market Garden, the Allies believed the Germans were on their last legs. At Ike's HQ, people thought about what the Allied armies could do to the Germans, not about what the Germans might do to them. The feeling was, if we can just get them from out behind the West Wall, we can finish the job. That attitude went right down to the enlisted man level. Sergeant George Koskimaki of the 101st wrote in his diary on December 17th, "It has been another quiet Sunday. The radio announced a big German attack on the First Army front. This should break the back of the German armies." The surprise was achieved, like most surprises in war, because the attackers did a good job of concealment and deception. They gathered two armies in the Eifel without Allied intelligence ever seeing them. By a judicious use of radio traffic, they got Ike's G2 looking to the north of the Ardennes for any German counterattack. No one in the Allied world thought for 1 minute that a German counteroffensive was conceivable. 6 months earlier, on the eve of D-Day, Ike and his officers had an almost perfect read on the German order of battle in Normandy. In December, on the eve of the German attack, Ike and his officers had a grossly inaccurate read on the German order of battle. The Allies were also badly deceived about the German will to fight, the German materiel situation, Hitler's boldness, and the skill of the German officers in offensive maneuvers. The American generals in the Allied camp had no experience of defending against a German offensive. The result of all this was the biggest single battle on the Western Front in World War II and the largest engagement ever fought by the U.S. Army. The human losses were staggering. Of the 600,000 American soldiers involved, almost 20,000 were killed, another 20,000 captured, and 40,000 wounded. Two infantry divisions were annihilated. In one of them, the 106th, 7,500 men surrendered, the largest mass surrender in the war against Germany. Nearly 800 American Sherman tanks and other armored vehicles were destroyed. The battle began on a cold, foggy dawn of December 16th. The Germans achieved a breakthrough at many points in the thinly held 8th Corps lines. Hitler had counted on bad weather to negate the Allies' biggest single advantage, air power. On the ground, in both men and armor, the Germans outnumbered the Americans. Hitler also counted on surprise, which was achieved, and on a slow American response. He figured that it would take Ike 2 or 3 days to recognize the magnitude of the effort the Germans were making. Another 2 or 3 days to persuade his superiors to call off the Allied offensives north and south of the Ardennes, and then another 2 or 3 days to start moving significant reinforcements into the battle. By then, the German armor would be in Antwerp, he hoped. It was his last assumptions that were wrong. On the morning of December 17th, Eisenhower made the critical decisions of the entire battle, and did so without consulting anyone outside his own staff. He declared the crossroads city of Bastogne as the place that had to be held no matter what. Bastogne is in a relatively flat area in the otherwise rugged hills of the Ardennes, which is why the roads of the area converge there. Because of his offensives north and south of the Ardennes, Ike had no strategic reserve available, but he did have the 82nd and the 101st, resting and refitting, and thus available. He decided to use the paratroopers to plug the holes in his lines and to hold Bastogne. Finally, Eisenhower blasted Hitler's assumptions by bringing into play his secret weapon. At a time when much of the German army was still horse-drawn, the Americans had thousands and thousands of trucks and trailers in France. They were being used to haul men, materiel, and gasoline from the beaches of Normandy to the front. Ike ordered them to drop whatever they were doing and start hauling his reinforcements to the Ardennes. The response can only be called incredible. On December 17th alone, 11,000 trucks and trailers carried 60,000 men, plus ammunition, gasoline, medical supplies, and other materiel into the Ardennes. In the first week of the battle, Eisenhower was able to move 250,000 men and 50,000 vehicles into the fray. This was mobility with a vengeance. It was an achievement unprecedented in the history of war. Not even in Vietnam, not even in the 1991 Gulf War, was the U.S. Army capable of moving so many men and so much equipment so quickly. Easy Company played its part in this vast drama thanks to the Transportation Corps and the drivers, mostly black soldiers of the famous Red Ball Express. At 20:30, December 17th, Ike's orders to the 82nd and 101st to proceed north toward Bastogne arrived at the division's HQ. The word went out to regiments, battalions, down to companies, "Get ready for combat." Trucks arriving in the morning were moving out. "Not me," Gordon Carson said. "I'm getting ready to play football on Christmas Day." "No, you're not," Lieutenant Dyke said. frantic preparations began. Mourmelon did not have an ammunition dump. The men had only the ammunition they had taken out of Holland. There was none to be found. Easy did not have its full complement of men yet, or of equipment. Some men did not have helmets. They did have football helmets, but not steel ones. The company was missing a couple of machine guns and crews.